This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi. This is Q, the podcast. Highlights from the October 25th edition of Q, the program. Okay, on your podcast today, Kenneth Branagh, the acclaimed director and actor of many a Shakespearean adaptation, goes chasing Olivier's mantle again with a remake of the 1972 classic Sleuth. He joins me. And we drop the gloves and five-minute majors are handed out when I chat with the authors of two recent hockey books, Steve Paikin and Lorna Jackson, plus Strombo, yes, George Strombolopoulos, that guy from a little show called The Hour, prepares to host and produce a big show called The Geminis. More Jude Law more often. This is Q. Sleuth, starring Jude Law and Michael Caine as two men caught in a cat-and-mouse game, hits theaters tomorrow. Here's a taste of this movie.
Andrew White.
That's right.
I'm Milo Tyndall.
Thanks for agreeing to see me.
What do you do, by the way?
I'm an actor.
Why have I never heard of you?
You will, before long.
That sounds threatening.
Does it?
Doesn't it? What sort of parts do you play?
Killers, mostly.
But you're so charming.
Yes, I know. Anyway, what about this divorce? She's never coming back to you, so why not just give her the divorce?
My wife spends money like water. She's born to luxury. What are you? Out of work actor? You're out of your depth, old boy. But I have a solution. And you can keep Maggie in the manner to which she's become accustomed.
And you agree to the divorce. So what do I do?
Aren't you the wicked one?
Well, Sleuth is a remake of the 1972 film classic of the same name, an entertaining but unnerving look at the games that men sometimes play as they fight over women, psychological power, and social position. Now, I saw this at the film festival in Toronto. I'm not sure if I'd call it a brilliant film, but it is riveting watching the two leads go at it. In fact, it's worth the price of admission. Absolutely. Jude Law and Michael Caine sparring is both entertaining and compelling in this film. So Michael Caine, who played the young upstart character in the 1972 version, is back, this time in the role of the manipulative Andrew Wyke, the part originally played by Sir Laurence Olivier. And Jude Law steps into Caine's former shoes as the young upstart, Milo Tyndall. So it's Alfie versus Alfie here. Alfie 1 versus Alfie 2. And the British powerhouse of talent behind Sleuth continues, with Nobel Prize winner Harold Pinter writing the new screenplay. And behind the camera, none other than Kenneth Branagh. Now, he's used to verbal sparring from his roles in many Shakespeare films and plays, including Hamlet and Henry V. He's a four-time Oscar nominee who's increasingly revered as a director. I had the pleasure of meeting with Kenneth Branagh during the Toronto International Film Festival earlier this fall. Here's our chat and what Branagh had to say about this postmodern meditation on male vanity.
How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
You have your caffeine?
I have my caffeine. I've been brought a kind of iced sort of milkshake style concoction that includes some caffeine that has been brought to me at this time where my blood sugar levels may be affected, and I'm hoping that it will have the appropriate impact.
This is the inside scoop on how Kenneth Branagh makes it through the day.
Yeah, how do I keep going? It's so amazing. Hopefully by the end of this interview, I won't be somebody you have to peel off the ceiling.
Well, I look forward to the slurping sounds throughout the interview. Let's start at the beginning. What grabbed you? What pulled you into Harold Pinter's screenplay of Sleuth?
The very thing itself, I was told about this new version of Sleuth and Harold Pinter had done the screenplay. That in itself was a thrill. When I was 16, I did an audition piece, a speech from his play, The Caretaker. And 30 years later, to even have the prospect of working with him was exciting. So hard to convey, an envelope comes through your front door and you know it is a Harold Pinter screenplay that hardly anybody's seen. I read it from start to finish, very, very swiftly, and I said to my wife, this is bloody marvellous. I said, it feels very dirty, however. It feels like a very dirty story, dirty psychologically. Have a read. And my wife read it. She said, yes, gosh, it's brilliant, and I know what you mean.
And what do you mean by dirty?
Well, it made you feel afterwards as though you needed a shower because you had been a voyeuristic kind of audience member at a really ugly fight between two men for whom their initial problem, a game fought over a woman who we never see, gets so far out of control and releases and unleashes such primal and sometimes ugly passions in them that you almost don't want to hear it or be in the room while it's happening, and yet you are compelled to do so. So you feel slightly dirty for eavesdropping on the most intimate and sometimes awful of secrets and accusations between people. I suppose that's what I mean.
Just that kind of dirty was enough for you to want to be.
Well, I guess it was sort of dirty in other ways, I suppose, as well. But what I liked, I mean, dirty in the sense also of primal, of primitive. You know, there was something about the piece that started with two fairly, it seemed, superficially civilized men, fairly sophisticated and speaking in relatively polite terms about a difficult issue, a younger man having an affair with an older man's wife, but somehow trying to do so in a grown-up matter, in manner. And very soon, these very thin layers of civility and civilization are stripped away, and they become very aggressive, and they engage in this game. There's a tennis match metaphor throughout, and each set is very vigorously played between the two participants.
And throughout the tennis match, I found myself much like a tennis match. Even if you don't know the players going in, you pick a side, and you begin to identify with one side. And they're starkly different characters. On the one hand, one guy, younger, it's played by Jude Law, working class, seemingly the outsider. The other, Michael Caine's character, the establishment, very upper class, older. Which one did you identify with?
What I liked about the screenplay was that your allegiances shifted. The central question at the beginning is, well, does Jude Law's character love this woman? Does Andrew love her? And is that what the prize is? Or does the prize then become money? Or does the prize then become the possession of the woman? And that Michael Caine's character is not about loving her or not loving her. It's about simply not losing to this younger man. Right. So now it becomes about the game. So then it becomes about winning. And then potentially it becomes about destruction. And so the rules change, and so our allegiances change. So who do I side with? Well, both of them, and sometimes with the wife at times.
I was going to say, it's a good answer, but you dodged it slightly. I said, who do you identify with? And I'm trying to get at whether you see yourself as an outsider or as the establishment.
I think to some extent, you know, this entire project was put together by outsiders. You know, there is some extent to which Harold Pinter, as esteemed and feted as he is by the world and Nobel Prize-winning playwright, perhaps the most performed playwright of the 20th century, but, you know, he's a very strongly political figure who's not made friends with some of the pronouncements he's made, passionately and full of conviction though they may be. I think, you know, Michael Caine, established as a kind of working class hero, breaking through a number of sort of taboos about what was right and proper in British cinema in the 60s. Jude Law is a brilliantly talented guy who's the subject of a great deal of, I would say, unfair observation and comment in our own fair land. And I suppose I ended up being somebody associated with the works of William Shakespeare, having come from a working-class Belfast family that did not have books in the house, which is no cri de coeur. I don't mean to sound like a Monty Python sketch. It's just a fact. And I, you know, sort of in theory, superficially, to some people, would be part of the establishment. All working-class boys on this, actually, however sort of so-called rich and famous we become.
Now that was a great answer. You really, I bought the outsider status there. But what about the star wattage? As a director and producer, when you're going into something, it's interesting. I saw it in a public screening, and I think the theater was consumed in the story, but at times, certainly when they embrace people on the screen, there's an ooh in the audience that's not about the characters.
Yes.
It's about Jude Law and Michael Caine are embracing. Do you worry going into something like this that the star wattage that rests on two soldiers through this film is going to outweigh the story?
I don't, because it's very... I mean, you really only get one go at being brilliant and unknown, don't you? It doesn't matter what you do, whether you're French, you're from wherever part of the world, you know. So you can get two complete unknowns to do this, and there'd be two very talented people who might do it brilliantly, and the story would be served in a different way. Frankly, it never bothered me. There's a nice sort of mirroring of things, and I don't feel it's a distraction for me anyway.
I have to ask you about the homoeroticism, which I just alluded to. These two men locked in a competition, fighting for control. What's the relationship between competition and attraction?
Well, I suppose if you are, it's a good question, if you are competitive by nature, then you must be very, very intrigued by the persons you're competing with. So that already has a kind of sort of invisible cord of tension, I suppose. And in this case, I think that Pinter presents very, very sophisticated competitors. And in the third act of this piece, with one set all, as they both agree, they've each managed to humiliate each other and be bonded by their humiliation. Now there's the issue of how Jude Law's character will react when Michael Caine's character says, do you know, I've come to the conclusion that you're my sort of person. By which you might read psychotic, desperate, you know, dangerous, violent, potentially murderous. Perhaps we should make a sort of partnership of this. You are unaware whether that is, whether, frankly, do you think that Michael Caine's character in that case is gay and inviting him to share his life with him, or is it the beginnings of some ultimate provocation which he will then humiliate him with at some point in the future? He'll pull the carpet out from under him. And by the time we get to an outrageous offer that says, I know you've just tried to kill me, how would you like to live with me instead? We know that something, you know, potentially very, very surprising might occur, and I think it does.
Well, let me end by asking you about men and this battle for control. What you've referred to throughout this interview a couple times as a game, I mean, obviously it spirals, as you've also said, into very severe waters, But it almost feels like the sign of winning is to outwit the other. This is like a 19th century, the French, who can be the wittiest and you win. How much of this is a game and how much of this is a real competition between these two men?
I think you put your finger on a question that Pinter's asking the audience, and I suppose that we embrace, it's a very Shakespearean theme, I think, to ask what is real. What is real and who is acting? Hamlet asks it of himself all the time. In about 18 months' time, I direct Jude Law in Hamlet. And we were talking about it the other day, saying, you know, I think we've just done something that starts to cover this area of men looking at each other or looking at themselves through each other and trying to work out who they are, what is genuine about what they feel. And actually, on the way to that, finally, that seems to be a couple of stages on the way to what makes you happy. What is happiness? And to work out what happiness is, you've got to find out who you are. And to find out who you are, you've got to find out what is real. This is an entertaining version via thriller, via black comedy, and seeing if you enjoy the game of working out whether people are genuine or play acting. And I loved working on it.
Thank you for this. You've made it halfway through the coffee milkshake thing, but you're not bouncing off the walls. I don't think.
I'm not wired. No, the coffee's fine, and it's been great. Thank you. Thank you. I said thank you.
Much appreciated.
Thanks a lot.
That was British actor, director Kenneth Branagh talking about his new film Sleuth, starring Michael Caine and Jude Law. Comes out tomorrow in theaters everywhere.
You've downloaded Q, the podcast with Gian Gameschi, highlights from CBC Radio 1's daily cultural magazine, and I am not Gian Gameschi.
Hockey season is underway, and the culture of hockey, its grip on our national consciousness, goes on all year round, as you all know out there. There's visual art about hockey, music about hockey, dance and theater about hockey, and lots of stories. And this fall, we've got two opinionated new books that look at the push and pull of our national sport. With me in the Q studio is television host and journalist Steve Paikin. He's the author of The New Game, How Hockey Saved Itself. And joining us from Victoria, writer Lorna Jackson. Her new collection of essays is called Cold Cocked on Hockey. And although I personally have yet to write a book about hockey, I want to. I'm also a hockey fan, so I'm looking forward to this conversation. Hello, Lorna and Steve.
Hi, Jean.
Hi Lorna. Steve. Hi, nice to meet you, Lorna.
You too.
Well, it's good to have you. I should note for CBC fans, this is not the CBC Lorna Jackson.
No.
Just to save you, Lorna, from people wondering why your voice sounds a bit different.
Thanks. It's about time somebody did that.
you're both obviously hockey fans, but neither of you actually play the game. Well, Steve, apparently you don't play very well, according to your book.
I play the game, but I play badly. How's that?
Right. Yeah. You play about as well as I do. I played hockey for many years as a kid, and I always tell people that I was taken off in a stretcher every other game.
Not a good thing.
To the chagrin of my parents, because I wasn't actually taken off in a stretcher, but I was almost that bad. But Steve, as a journalist, we associate you with the political beat. Why did you want to write a book about hockey?
Because it's so much like politics, and frankly, I've written 3 books on politics already, so I've said what I want to say on that. But if you think about it, you know, they're both body contact sports. They're both elbows up. They're both about winning and losing. They're both about drama. There's lots of theater in both of them. Your teammates are sometimes the worst people in the world, and sometimes the guy that you want to defeat is really your best pal. So I think they have a lot more in common than most people think.
That makes a lot. And you're a huge hockey fan.
I am indeed.
Since you're
for 40 years.
Growing up in Hamilton, Ontario,
yep.
Right? And Lorna, what about you? You come from a literary background. You've also been a musician. You teach a fiction and creative writing course at the University of Victoria. Why did hockey draw you as a subject?
That was kind of the question I asked myself. What the heck's going on after the 2002 Olympics, when I found I couldn't look away from it. Unlike Steve, I haven't been a fan for 40 years. I was in the 60s and 70s watching the Habs and the Bruins with my dad, but then I'd gotten away from it for a long time, and then became completely obsessed again and wanted to ask those questions. Why me? Why now? Why this game?
And your book is called A Born-Again Hockey Aficionado. Explain why you're born again.
Well, because I became so passionate, and because I think it had a lot to do with the players that I was seeing in those Olympics. And I wasn't alone. I was talking to a lot of other people who had left the game for a while, not that interested, and suddenly they were back. And seeing European players, seeing Canadian players that they'd never seen, and seeing a game that was quite different than the one they'd left.
It's a great multicultural sport, you know. If you think about it, there's no other sport, no other major North American sport where you have people on the same ice surface trying to be teammates and do pinpoint passing to one another, some of whom speak Swedish, yeah. Czech, French, English, German, Kazakh, Ukrainian, Russian. I mean, it's amazing.
You make this point in your book, although I want to pick this up in a few minutes, because I'm curious about whether hockey in Canada is going to continue to be the multicultural sport in the context of the changing nature of Canada and the face of Canada. But I just want to find out a little bit more about you two and why you wrote these books first. So back to you, Steve. I mean, it's interesting that Lorna has come back to hockey. The subtext of your book is something of a suggestion that there is a renaissance around hockey, although you never left it, right?
I never left hockey, but I think it's fair to say there have been more changes in the National Hockey League, which is the biggest and best hockey league in the world. More changes in the last 2 years than there have been in the previous 50. If you think it through about what's happened since the lockout, where they lost that entire 2004-05 season, they've changed the rules dramatically. They've changed the salary structure dramatically. They've changed the economic system dramatically. You know, it's just a much better... I can't find more than 3 people anywhere in Canada who don't think that it's a better game today as a result of all the rule changes. And so while I never left hockey...
You can find 2 or 3, but not more than 3.
Not many more than that. No, not many more. Okay. I really appreciate all the changes. It's not perfect, but I think they've really come a long way.
Now, I'm going to get to that as well. But back to you, Lorna, for a moment. One thing that interested me about your book is I'm the kid growing up who read a bunch of hockey books from as soon as I came to Canada. I was 7, 8 years old, and I became obsessed by hockey. And I guess this speaks to the multicultural nature, because here I am, this Iranian kid who's grown up in London, England, and I come here and become obsessed with hockey. And by the way, Lorna, you mentioned in your book you had a crush on Derek Sanderson.
I still do, kind of.
The first book I ever read was The Derek Sanderson Nobody Knows.
That's a great book, actually.
It was an interesting book to read as a kid.
Yeah.
I mean, here I am reading. I didn't know who Derek Sanderson was. He was sort of before my time, but I'm reading it, and it's all about these, you know, his illicit and affairs with groupies. And I was thinking, well, hockey's really not so bad, is it?
No.
But what's interesting to me, having read all of those books, is it's rare to find a woman writing about hockey from a woman's perspective, especially in an essay collection called Cold Cocked. Was that point of view missing for you in writing about hockey, Lorna?
It was, and I kind of wanted to speak to the dominant narrative that maybe Steve's alluding to as well, that tells us about the game, how to watch the game, how to feel about the game. And I didn't think that there was a female perspective, and I don't think there's enough of a multicultural perspective either, actually. So what I wanted to do was make the game more complex, make the reading of it more complex, and look at a couple of other ways of seeing it. Maybe post-lockout, but also, you know, I'm going to disagree with Steve. I'm not one of those three people. I don't think, maybe part of me is, but I think those changes to the game started well before the lockout.
Yeah, you kind of pinned the excitement around the Olympics, the early new millennium Olympics, right?
Yeah, and what was happening there, I think, and before the lockout, was a change in the character of the players and the way that we were seeing players and identifying with them. The Europeans had a lot to do with that, I think. I think they brought a different character, a different motivation, definitely changed the game, but I'm talking more about how fans, and maybe particularly women, identify with players and how they want to see them as part of a story, and how they see them more as characters a lot of the time than they do as hockey players.
So the general opening up of the league, especially, and the internationalization of the NHL, you think has had an impact on the excitement around hockey for people like you?
I know it has for people like me, and I think it has for a lot of people.
Steve, what do you think of that, given that you really make the point over and over again in your book that the lockout and the changes, the rule changes that were made, have created this change in hockey?
I think the changes have been positive, and when I just a moment ago heard you describe your life story of how you came to this country and turned on to hockey, it reminded me of a chapter I've got in the new game about a guy named Sudarshan Maharaj. Now, if that doesn't sound like a typical hockey name, there's a reason for that. I mean, he was a kid born in Trinidad and Tobago and came up here to the, you know, frigid north when he was a young kid and wanted to figure out how to fit in, and so started to watch hockey on TV, started to play road hockey, started to take a bus an hour and a half each way to go to the arena to be a goaltender because he got pretty good at it. And son of a gun, if the guy didn't work his way all the way up to become the goaltending coach for the New York Islanders. They recently had a regime change there, and he got regime changed out, but he'll be back. And this is one of the wonderful things about hockey. We talked about whether it's a multicultural sport. You bet your bibby it is. This is something everybody can you know, it's part of being Canadian in many respects.
Is it, though?
Yeah, I think it is.
I mean, because I think part of what Lorna's argument is that it's still the old boys and the old white boys delivering the hockey to us to a certain extent, right?
In what respect?
Well, it's interesting, too. I mean, you've got four of the six Canadian teams captained by European players, Swedes and Finns, and yet Canadians didn't really watch that gold medal game in the last Olympics between those two teams, even though their most storied captains and citizens of their communities were on those teams.
Well,
why
it's
is
about
that?
It is at the end of the day about being Canadian. You know, the Maple Leaf does make a difference, and you're right. I think it is a fascinating observation that so many of the Canadian teams are captained by Europeans. But at the end of the day, we want Canada. We want Canada to win, preferably over the United States or Russia. That's just the way it is.
Well, I think in Vancouver, you see, I mean, multiculturalism is alive. Mm-hmm. The audience is not only male, female, but, you know, every ethnicity that you'd want to mention. And that's part of the pleasure of going to a Canucks game.
You know, I'll say yes and no on this. And I do say this as a guy from an Iranian background who's a huge hockey fan. The kind of diversity I see around, say, World Cup soccer or at basketball games,
yeah, but that's
I don't
different.
Necessarily... Why is
no,
that
that's
different?
Because those are sports that are played in the old world. The hockey's not played in Iran. Hockey's not played in some of the places where so many Canadians are. Ethiopia, Somalia, they don't play hockey there.
Well, and the question becomes, as Canada continues to change, and if we look into the future 2-3 decades from now, not just now, but because it still seems to be working now that the arenas are packed out, I can't get Leaf tickets. But if you look ahead, does hockey need to adapt? Somehow, does the face of hockey and the way it's presented need to adapt to change to the changing face of Canada?
I think, and someone's going to help me with the year here, but I think it was the World Championships in 2003 or 4, where the face of Canadian hockey was a black kid from Scarborough with dreadlocks, Anson Carter, who scored the winning goal in overtime. And I remember as soon as he put the puck in the net, I said, isn't this fabulous? Look at what the face of Canadian hockey is today. This game is adapting and changing and morphing and doing everything I think it needs
or
to
Ray
do.
Or Ray Emery or Jerome McGinley.
Absolutely.
Lorna?
Well, I think I think part of how we're going to have to start thinking differently about the game is that Toronto's going to have to start thinking that they're not the game.
Well, they're going to have to get a team first. That would help. That's another story.
It's easy to not think we're the game where we're playing as badly as...
Well, part of that dominant narrative comes west from you guys, and it's constantly referring to Toronto and Ontario as the game. Why is it right now the most profound question that journalists are asking is, are the Leafs going to make the playoffs? We're 6 months away from that.
Steve,
why
you're a journalist who lives in Toronto. You want to answer that?
The Leafs are a cult, and I think that everybody in the rest of Canada has just got to kind of come to grips with that. They're not a normal sports franchise. They are a cult. They are an astonishingly successful institutional international brand, and that's just the way it is. And I'm sorry if it takes some attention away from the Canucks and the Oilers and the Flames, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not from Toronto, so I can say this. That's just the way it is.
Hamilton boys.
That's it.
The words. Listen, I'm so excited to talk about hockey, and I have very little time here. So I've just got time for one more question. I really wanted to get into, Steve, your book and your thesis about how it's called The New Game, the book, and how hockey saved itself. And you talk about the changes made during the lockout, and hockey fans across the country will know what I'm talking about and what you're talking about and what Lauren's talking about when we talk about those changes after the lockout, rule changes to make the game faster. Less interference, less fighting in some cases.
Let the talented players show
their
stuff.
More scores. Yeah. 2 years ago, beginning of the season, after the lockout, I was so excited. The game looked very different to me. Mm-hmm. It looked so exciting to me. The scores were running up. There was a whole... And I feel like this season, and I'm not the only one saying this, things are slowly beginning to revert back. They're figuring out how to play the New Jersey Devils trap style of hockey
without
the red line. There's interference, there's fighting's back up again, the scores are lower. It doesn't feel like it's made the big difference.
Two things on that. Number one, you live in Toronto, you're watching way too much Maple Leaf hockey, which has not been very good hockey this year, so that may be part of the reason why you believe that.
Watch other games.
But the other thing is, you've got to remember, it doesn't matter what sport it is. Offenses innovate and defenses catch up. And that's just the nature of the cycle of sports. And I have no doubt but that when the defenses catch up again and figure it all out, we're already seeing new kinds of neutral zone traps, terrible things that they are. But offenses will innovate again, and that doesn't concern me too much. What people need to remember is it wasn't that long ago. It was only a few years ago that people were saying, this game sucks. That's what Brett Hull said. This game sucks. It's no fun to play. It's no fun to watch. I don't hear people saying that anymore, and I don't see people when the score's tied 3-3 and about to go into overtime and then a shootout getting up and leaving early anymore. It's better now.
Lorna, your thoughts on how the game might have changed after post-lockout?
Well, I think part of that slowdown that you're seeing has to do with the number of penalties still being called. Trevor Linden promised us and predicted that at the end of the lockout, it was going to take players 6 months to figure out when they were going to be penalized and how that was going to work.
Longer.
And it's
yeah, they're still
night after
it
night,
out.
The game is slowed down by it being played in one end on the power play, and I'm pretty bored with that by now. I don't like special teams hockey. I want 5-on-5 as much as can be played, and I think whether it's the refs changing the standards for those penalties, why last year interference was being called and this year it seems to me it's not. I'm not sure, but that's what's slowing the game down right now.
You know, I've got about 30 seconds left, just enough time. I know, Steve, what were you itching to say there?
I was itching to say that that doesn't disturb me too much, because these the people who play hockey have been trained the same way to do it for 20, 25 years, and it will take them more than 6 months to figure out how to adjust.
Both of your books, for hockey fans out there, I find very, very entertaining. Steve, I love the anecdotes about how bad a hockey player you are, and and your take on Ty Domi. And Lorna, you won my heart with your feelings about Derek Sanderson. Last question to both of you, very, very quickly. Who's going to win the cup? Go ahead, Steve.
Who's going to win the Stanley Cup?
Yes.
I have no idea.
You're a hockey expert.
I have
now.
No idea.
Come on, you have a book.
Yeah, but you know, who would have picked the Anaheim Ducks before last year?
Well, I did, actually. That was me.
Lorna, she would have.
I know it's not going to be the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Is it going to be the Canucks, Lorna, your team?
You got to stop fantasizing. You got to stop obsessing about the final result. You got to enjoy the story.
Amen. No, I agree with that.
Although I love Chicago this year.
You know, when you've been kept out in my lifetime, the Toronto Maple Leafs have not won a Stanley Cup. So, you know, when you've been kept out of the...
Just proves you're too young.
Kept in the dark for as long as I have. Lorna, you obsess about these things. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Great.
Steve Paikin, the author of the new book, The New Game, How Hockey Saved Itself. And Lorna Jackson joining us from Victoria. She's the author of Cold Cocked on Hockey.
This is Q, the podcast. We're on CBC Radio 1 twice each weekday after local and regional noon programs, and again at 10 p.m., 10:30 in Newfoundland.
Well, this Sunday at the Gemini Awards in Regina, the man of the hour will be the man who hosts the hour, that TV Renaissance guy, George Strombolopoulos. He's in Regina now, prepping for the big show. Not only is he hosting the English TV Love-a-thon, he's producing it, and he's an award winner himself, taking home the trophy for Best TV Talk Show Host/Interviewer. And George is in our Regina studio. I know that because I can hear him breathing. Hello, George.
Gian, I am your father.
Gian rhymes with neon. I am co-producing it with several very talented people. If I did it by myself, it would suck.
How are you, man? Congratulations, first of all, on the
job. No, thanks, buddy.
I appreciate that.
Thank you. No, you know what
it is? Feel good?
Yeah, well, it does. And here's why it feels good, and you can relate to this as well. It's if anybody recognizes what you do, and often when you're the host, you get the credit, but it's a reflection on what your team has done. And so it's nice because it's nice for the team, you know. You go, hey, listen, you guys all kill yourself for this program. So it's a nice bit for everybody.
It is. So kudos. I've heard you wanted to make the Geminis really different this year. It's part of the reason you got involved in producing it. Why did you want to do that, and what did you want to do?
Well, I mean, they asked me to do the show, and my initial reaction was no. And I said that. And that's because, I mean, I like the way the Geminis do their show, but it's not something that I sort of fit into in terms of the kind of host that I am. And they said they want it to be a little bit different. I went, okay, I can do that. I think it's important.
It's not something that you fit into, do you think?
Well, here's the thing. I'm the kind of Canadian that watches television from all over the world, right? I think the celebration of Canadian television should be a celebration of Canadian talent, right? Who work everywhere in the world. And so we created an award this year specifically designed for Canadians who are working on shows that aren't eligible for a Gemini because they're not Canadian shows. Mm. But it's about celebrating Canadians all over the world. I think it's funny. This country is built on people coming here to work and live, and we just ignore Canadians when they leave. Huh. That makes no sense to me. So I want to celebrate Canadians who are working in this country and Canadians who aren't working
in
this country.
So give me an example of the Canadians who aren't working in this country that will be celebrated.
There's a million, man. Sarah Chalk, Howie Mandel, Kristen Krug. You start going, you know, Taylor Kitsch. You look at all the... you know, and those are like, you know, the actors, and Michael Cera, you know, Will Arnett. I mean, there's a bazillion. There's all the writers. Right. I mean,
it does make sense in the sense that we don't hand out Juno Awards to people who only perform in Canada. Well, you know, if Nelly Furtado's on an international tour, she still gets a Juno Award, right?
Of course. And I mean, well, Canadians are still very provincial and smug about Canadians who go to America. And to be honest with you, that's kind of boring to me. You know, you go where the job is, and I think it's nice to celebrate. I mean, most people who work in the States who are Canadian would love to make a living, a good one, in their home country, and they can't. We don't have the business to support it. But what we do have is this incredible talent pool that should be celebrated wherever they are. This is not the first year it's happening. It's the first year we're doing this award, but over the years, the Geminis have become more and more open, the Academy more and more open to the Canadians who are everywhere, and I think it'll be nice.
Do you worry that sort of shifting to that focus means taking a bit of the emphasis in China away from celebrating Canadian television?
Of course not. There's only one award, right? The Viewer's Choice Award. Every other award is for Canadian shows. So that's kind of my point, right, dude? Is that what we do in Canada. If for one second we do something slightly different, people get all weirded out. You know, this show is celebrating all the Canadians working in Canada, as well as, you know, Canadians kind of working everywhere. It's about people who are Canadians who are working in the world.
You know, Canadian TV does seem to be on the rise these days. Big successes for mm-hmm. Little Mosque internationally, Little Mosque on the Prairie. Corner Gas is huge. Both of them shot where you are right now.
Yeah, and Brent Butt threw out the first pitch at Wrigley Field. How cool is that?
Yeah, we had him on the show right after that. Or no, we had him on the show a couple weeks ago, and he talked about that. But I'm curious. First of all, it's interesting that you're in Saskatchewan. Everything is happening in Saskatchewan these days, right?
Yeah. It's the value of great tax credits, baby.
Well, it's been an amazing year for that province, from the Junos to the CCMAs to the WCMAs last weekend, which was what I was there for. But now the Gemini Awards. And these two shows that are shot out of, Corner Gas is the entire thing. Thing is shot in Saskatchewan, yeah. And of course Little Mosque is set there. How do you see keeping the momentum going for Canadian television?
Do you want my honest answer?
Yes, of course.
I think the onus is on the networks, dude, and not just the CTVs, the CBCs, and the Globals, but the onus is on cable television. In America, network television for the most part blows, right? And it was cable television that made television what it is. We're in the golden age of television right now. It's never in history been this good, where they close the book on a show like The Sopranos, and you have shows like Californication, they close 6 feet Under, and you have shows like Dead Like Me. You go through all of HBO and Showtime's lineup, right? They're the ones that make good shows. There is no shortage of talent in this country. I think that the CRTC has done a disservice to the Canadian talent pool by not making networks run, primetime Canadian programming. I think in the way that the CRTC ran the Canadian radio industry with an iron fist, which is the reason why...
So all networks should be legislated to play Canadian...
There's got to be some representation of Canadian television, Canadian-made shows, in primetime. I really think there does. But I think what it is, it's not just about legislation, because I don't want to get into that, as socialist, like, let's just control it by the government, because who trusts the government?
But that's what you were just suggesting, right?
No, but I'm saying there's got to be a part of it. I think the other thing that needs to happen is that I think that the Canadian film business needs to be supported better, because if we have a strong Canadian film industry, we'll have a better Canadian television industry. What makes Hollywood work so well is the transfer between TV and film, right? And I think there's a lot of great talent in this country that need, where do you go see a Canadian film? So I think that we've got these shows now that are making the move. So in order to continue the momentum, the Canadian film business needs better support.
Specifically, what do you want to see more of on Canadian?
I want to see Canadian films in theaters.
But it's, what kind of films and TV do you want to see these days in Canada?
In
Canada.
That's the other thing. I want all kinds. I think that in order to make to get funding for a Canadian show, there has to be meet this unbelievable Canadian criteria for content. I think that's ridiculous. I think my favorite Canadian movie of the last 30 years, was It's All Gone Pete Tong. It had nothing to do with Canada except for the fact that Michael Dowse wrote it and made it.
Fantastic film.
It was set, and it was
so good.
It wasn't another story in the prairies or another, gritty urban Vancouver gang drama. Which is what we always make in this country. And, that's what I really like about Corner Gas and Little Mosque on the Prairie, right? Is they're poking fun at themselves. One thing we're really good at is, we're really good at having some fun with ourselves, but also sort of expanding. Little Mosque on the Prairie took an idea that it's easy to understand right away. You hear the title? I know what that is. That's a bit of range. I think in Canada, we need to start making shows that, we should just let Canadian talent do what they do. And support them and beat them. But I mean very specifically, they have to have shows, movies that run inside theaters. I think that, and you got to wait for 5 years. It's going to take 5 years for the audience to sort of catch on.
Okay, here we go. Since you're hosting the Canadian TV Awards,
mm-hmm.
I think you should show the nation how much you really know about TV.
You're a jackass.
You call me a jackass.
This
is trivia.
No,
I'm not going to hose you. I think you'll actually get some of this stuff. Okay, right. And the nation will understand.
Everybody,
I'm sure the listeners
will
understand. These can be tough questions, mm-hmm. but you are hosting the Geminis, George. You got to do your research, right? All right. So you're going to hear a buzz there. If you're wrong, or a ding,
Well, why don't you just put the buzz on loop right now? First of all, it's not just celebrating Canadian TV shows. It's about celebrating Canadian talent.
Wait for the questions. Look, you're all so right. Why are you so scared?
Because
it's going to be fine.
Because I know you.
No. It's going to be fine. All right. Let's start off with this one. Now, this is a clip from a show that won a Gemini for Best Reality TV Show. Have a listen.
This has been a long journey for both of you. And for one of you, it ends here. For the other one, this is just the beginning. Can you both please step forward?
Okay, so you know what that show that is?
Wouldn't be Fashion File.
It's close. Very close.
Yeah, it's not
very close.
Designed, is it Style by Jury? Can't remember.
Canada's Next.
Is that the Next Top Model?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, you gave me that one, though, but I knew that the idea. Okay.
Okay, so now...
Buzz me
well,
wrong.
They won Best Reality... That show won Best Reality Show, but who actually won that Top Model competition? Here's your Canadian talent.
I have no idea.
All right.
I've never watched that show.
Here's who it is.
Canada's Next Top Model is... Rebecca.
Oh, my God.
Feel the drama there, right?
I'm sure she's very beautiful.
Rebecca Hardy won.
Okay, good.
And the real question is, what color is her hair? And it's red. All right, trivia question number two. If you don't get this one, I'll be very disappointed.
Dude, I'm going to go over, but
listen
I'm okay
to me.
With
listen,
that.
Listen. Last year, in September, Global Television canceled a long-running sports show. 25 years running.
Sportsline?
There you go.
Yes, guy.
Give him the ding. Nicely done.
I used to run home from school to watch Mark Hebster and Jim Taddy do that show.
That was the second question. Who are the original hosts?
Oh,
give them another ding.
Yes, guys.
There you go. You see? It's not so bad. and you know that show, do I have this correct? I mean, I think I remember that show was the progenitor. That was the one that created the model for all the sports desk, sports line, sports.
For sure. That was the show that let Canadian sports anchors have a real personality. And they sort of established who they were, right? You remember TSN had started but was doing a very traditional thing, and then even later, and TSN obviously is what set the stage for Sportsnet and the score and all that. But it was Taddy and Hebscher where we actually built a relationship with our evening sports hosts.
It had never been, I remember it being so foreign. We were kids and these guys, they would make jokes, they would show the game last night. Okay, so you're doing well. You're 2 for 3 or 4. Okay.
I didn't know the name of the model either.
What supporting actor on a Canadian TV show was named after this person?
Now, Mr. Chairman, I do believe we must have a Canadian Bill of Rights to guarantee the preservation of fundamental political, constitutional, and personal freedoms.
All right. So you remember that voice?
Yeah. But who was named after Tom? Who was named after him?
That's the Diefenbaker.
John Diefenbaker. Who's named after Diefenbaker?
Yeah.
And he's a Gemini-winning supporting actor.
Actor is in quotes.
Oh, this past year?
No. I got to give this to Joy. This is one. It was Diefenbaker. That was Paul Gross's half-wolf dog on Due South.
Okay.
Okay. Show aired from 1994 to 99. It was the first Canadian made for TV.
It's a dog?
but people who know Due South might, they might know that. I'm looking at these questions, trying to figure out. Here's one. Okay, blast from past. Here's a clip of a famous CBC broadcaster talking about another famous CBC broadcaster. See if you can figure out who these guys are.
I didn't watch CBC.
I know, George. I'm sorry. Here we go. Just try it. Here.
He never bothered to check a fact. He never let a good story get in the way of the truth. And he said this himself. I said to him once, Gordon, you've just given a broadcast in which every word is wrong. Everything is wrong. I know. He said, that's me. I'm often wrong. That's the way he was. How can you dislike a guy like that?
Was that a front page challenge thing?
Yes.
Was it Gordon Sinclair he's talking about?
Yes.
Was it not Pierre Burton? Who is it?
Yes.
That's what I thought.
You got him all right.
There you go.
There you go.
I remember watching that show, man. That show had Malcolm X on. Front Page Challenge had Malcolm X on. It was hilarious. It was
What we've learned today, George, is you should overcome some of your fears are unwarranted.
No, my fears, Gian, are that because you and I are good friends, this is a prime opportunity for us to take each other apart on the air.
No, you did well. You did well. Listen,
I'm disappointed that I didn't know who the model was. Damn it, I should. I knew Pierre Burton and Gordon Sinclair, but I didn't know the model.
It's probably
no wonder
a good thing.
I go to bed alone.
I think the listener. Oh, okay, yeah. Cry as a river, George. It's tough being you. Listen, you are, I often say this, and you are the hardest working person I know. You never stop. Congratulations on the, winning the Gemini and hosting, and have a good time on. No. Try and have a good time on Sunday night in between producing.
Thank you, man. And I will say this quite sincerely. Your interview you did a couple of weeks ago with Basha Bulat. It was amazing.
Oh, thank you.
And that kid, her brother Bobby, who the drummer in that band, if there's anybody listening who's a fan of really like aggressive but kind of funny punk rock and sort of hard, Bobby is in a band called 2 Minutes Too Late, who had a song called Arm the Bears, an anti-hunting song. You got to check it out. And it is the opposite of his sister's music. So when I heard him on your show, and I was really pleased that you had them on. So your show is the one that's doing it.
Thanks for saying that, George. We have the dude count. We were trying to count how many times you were going to call me dude.
How many did I do?
Only two.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah, I was a little
Do I call you dude a lot?
Yeah, you sometimes call me
how
dude.
How about bro? I call you bro sometimes.
I like bro.
Yeah, bro's good.
Strong bro.
Broham, because you sound like an awesome car.
Thanks, George.
Thanks, Gian.
Good luck on Sunday. We'll be
Thanks,
watching.
Buddy. All right. Thanks, bro.
George Strombolopoulos, producing and hosting the Geminis. Tune in this Sunday night at 8 p.m. on CBC Television. You've been listening to Q, the podcast. Hey, you can hear Q, the program, every weekday afternoon and evening on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Satellite 137. I'm Gian Gomeshi. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.